There is no such thing as a boring topic, only
boring speakers.
So as a great speaker, you can make any topic interesting. Now, do you believe me? There's no such thing as a boring topic, only a boring speaker.
Yeah.
Now, some topics are more challenging than other topics. All right, who chose warts? How do you make warts interesting to an audience? You can make it interesting. And the key is this: what's in it for me? Why should I care? Why should I listen? And you have to do that in the first how many seconds? First 30 seconds. Why should I care? Why should I listen to you? And what's in it for me? And that's a critical thing with any type of speaking that you do. Even if it's persuasive speaking on genetics. You know, and you also want to know why your listeners are here. And that's just such a critical thing. And I'll hit that again and again. What's in it for me? Why should I care? You know, people aren't going to listen to you unless you give them a reason to. Now, other things you need to do is make sure that your topic's not too trivial. You know, the proper use of a garbage disposal. How to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And if you can use this, a lot of times you can get the WIFM with interest, their interests and their well-being. And always provide the conclusion, what you want them to believe, because most of the time they won't do that themselves. Make sure you give it all you have as far as your energy. A lot of times it's frustrating as a speaker when they say you're going to have 200 people there and 5 people show up because they forgot to advertise or something like that. You still need to give it your energy because your name's on the line and it's the professional thing to do. The biggest mistake that anybody makes with speaking is the topic is too broad, saying too much. You're not going to have that much time. And the central idea, you should be able to say that in one sentence. What's your speech about? You should be able to tell me in one sentence and not in a form of a question. Some things to avoid: technical terms. Avoid technical terms unless you know the whole group will understand them. There's the rule of three. You don't want to go over 3 points usually in your speech. You have 3 points. Because it's tough to speak on a shopping list. If I was going to do a 5-minute speech on 101 ways for self-improvement, it would just be too much. It would be too much of an overload. Appeal to your emotions. We'll spend some time talking about that. Are we emotional creatures or logical creatures? Do we believe our emotions more than our logic? Do we? Anybody here have children? I remember growing up when there was a monster underneath the bed and all the logic in the world. Look, there's no monsters, there's no monster under your bed, but what do people still believe? There's a monster in the bed. So emotions are very, very powerful, and you want to appeal to their emotions. And so what is something, if you were going to go into an audience and speak, what would you want to know about that audience? Interests, age, occupation, education, gender, be the emotional, logical makeup of the audience, the mood, is it fun, is it serious, culture, religion. They say that you choose a SMART objective, that it's, when you think about what you want to accomplish, that it's specific. You should know exactly what you want to accomplish before you start to speak. What do you want your audience to believe, feel, or do? Is it measurable? How do you know if you've been successful? Is it achievable in the amount of time? Is it achievable, period? If you're giving one speech on saving the rainforest, it's not going to happen in one speech. Is it relevant to what they want and what they want to listen to? And can you do it in the time frame? As far as preparation is concerned, the first thing you need to know is your objective, of course. And a lot of times it's better to write your closing before the rest of the speech, because the closing is going to dictate exactly what you want them to do. What we call the call to action. What do you want them to do? And prepare your transitions, because your mind will remember things in groups. You need to, when you speak, have a transition. What is a transition? Moving one point, you just make it smooth. Transition, you know, the second step is, the next point is, just a transition to take us between point to point. Very important. Some people don't tend to think about those ahead of time. And some things that you want to hear about your speech, that it was easy to understand and that it was interesting. What are some of the keys of an effective rehearsal? Watch yourself do it in the mirror, lock yourself in the bathroom. It's best to practice standing how you're going to be standing. How many of you mentally rehearse? Okay, visualize it. We talked about putting yourself in the situation, seeing your audience loving what you're saying, laughing at your jokes. Practice your stories and humor on other people. Some people even do a dress rehearsal. You're welcome to videotape yourself. Practice your eye contact. It's almost even better, too, to practice to tape your notes up onto the mirror, onto a wall, so you're still looking at something and you can practice with your arms. It'll make a huge difference. Now, should we use a script? Why not? Should you write out your script, your talk word for word? Does anybody do that? I mean, it's not that it's bad. Some people it works very well for. A lot of people, they get stuck in it when they get lost. But some people start out writing it word for word, and then they do, you know, kind of an outline. I'm just giving you four different ways people do script, so you can kind of take what works for you. There's the word for word. You have to be careful. Sometimes it comes across as dull and lifeless if you keep it that way. There's an outline, just a traditional outline. There's the keyword outline, just one word. That's kind of what I do, just kind of one word at a time to let me know what to go next. And that's what's a great thing about PowerPoint presentation is you can do an 8-hour presentation without notes, because guess where your notes are? In PowerPoint, which PowerPoint is basically just a keyword outline. That's what it is. And some people do pictographs. And of course, we've all had a telemarketer call us, right? Reading from a script. Have we had that before? Hi, Jim. Pause. How are you? Pause. Ask them about their day. How was your day? You know, how does that make you feel? Impersonal, and it just has to be very, very careful with those. So scripts tend to be mechanical and lifeless. And so what you want to do is you want your presentation to explode the subject, to get your audience interested, to bring them in, to support your audience, and understand exactly what you want to do. Because there's a couple different areas you can persuade, enlighten, amuse, train, educate, or doctrinate. So as we talk about the WIFM, I'm going to hammer this one home because it's critical, and a lot of you will still forget to put it in your speeches. Now, we talked about TV and the MTV generation. We need to change scenarios about every 6 minutes. Does that make sense as far as doing something different? Yeah. Story or video, get you to move around. Now, have you ever given an impromptu speech in your life? Any fun? Interesting? What is the audience mindset during an impromptu speech? We know that you're on the spot, and so we're a lot more lenient as far as our judging is concerned versus if you've been assigned for 2 weeks to give this talk. What is the characteristics of an impromptu? I mean, think of even, you can't call them impromptus when you look at the award ceremonies on TV, the Academy Awards. You like to think they're impromptus, but I'm sure they're pretty well thought out. But even think of those acceptance speeches. What do you like and dislike about it? Now, what about an impromptu speech? What do you like about an impromptu speech? Someone that's just out of the crowd. Entertaining, fun, spontaneous. Great impromptu speech draws from events of the day or something that happened that day that you can kind of relate. Impromptu speech is usually a quote or a story that you can use, and that's part of the preparation. That could be a story or a quote or something that you can use. Do you think you could use the same quote for 20 different impromptu speeches or a story, something that you could learn? But I want to see creativity, and I want to see poise. And so some things that you want to look at as far as, you know, with the occasion, who's going to be there, but being creative and having fun with it and drawing from the audience and putting things together. And you just have to follow your instinct on this one as far as what's the appropriate thing to say and how to do it. And you know, an impromptu is always an impromptu. It's never going to be perfectly polished. You want to take a look at maybe a funny story or how to humanize with people in the room. Again, poise and creativity is important. Yeah. And half the process is getting your brain to spark fast to get things going. And it takes a while to get in that pattern. That's where, you know, you talk to people that are doing improv, they're always doing scenarios in their head and doing different things because it takes practice. And so part of getting ready for an improv is, or just an impromptu, is mentally prepare yourself to get up in front of the audience, find some stories or quotes that you can use just to have, and practice different things. Because part of it's just confidence and getting your brain to spark fast enough and get things going. You know, pull from your experiences. Be creative. If you can relate to something again that happened that day, it makes a big, big difference. Okay, any questions on that? Shall we see a sample?
Hello.
All right, well, hey, give me one. You want me to do this?
Yeah.
Put me on the spot? Give me one. All right, should I try a speeding ticket? That's a tough one. All right, the situation, I'm getting pulled over for a speeding ticket, and I'm trying to get out of it. I was going 20 over. 45, was I swerving? 40
over.
Yeah. 40 over?
You're so drunk.
You're 90. Okay. You just want to make it more interesting while we're at it? So we get called up. Okay. Well, Judge, I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to my case. I know it sounds unique. I know I sound guilty, but I just have to tell you what was happening because I know you'll find it in your heart that it was something that could have even happened to you. I know I was naked. I know I smelled like beer. I know I was going 40 miles an hour and I was swerving like a madman. I acknowledge that. But I have this rare disorder that I grew up with when I was a child. I have this fear of bees. And I was just driving along the interstate enjoying the day, and I had my sunroof open, and I was just enjoying the fresh air, and this big bee flew in my car. And I panicked. I knew it wasn't right. I knew I shouldn't have, but I panicked. This bee started buzzing around. I didn't know what to do, and I started hitting it, and my, you know, I don't drink. You know, I'd never drink in the car, but my roommate, he's kind of a drunkard. And so there was a can of brew in the back, and so I opened it, and I tried to splash the bee, and then it got madder and madder at me, and then I didn't know what else to do, and I wanted to whip it with something, and well, so I, you know, what's the best thing to whip with? Your pants. And so I took my pants off, started whipping the bee, and I started swerving all over the place, and I was speeding up, hoping that the wind would suck the bee out, and it was getting madder and madder and madder, and just things started happening. And I'm sure you can understand, Honor, you know, it just things were happening and so fast, and this bee was getting mad, and I'm allergic to bees, and the bee would have stung me, I would have ballooned up. And so I tried all these techniques, and then finally the police officer pulled me over, and when I slowed down, the bee finally flew out of the car, and he couldn't see the bee, and the bee was there, and that's why I find myself in this predicament. And I call on your heart and your passion, and to know that I would never do anything illegal, but you know, I was just so scared of bees. I have hypobechondria, and it's a very dangerous thing. And so please find it in your heart to find me not guilty.
Guilty.
Guilty. That was a tough one. That was really. So, I mean, have fun with it. Pick a central point. I mean, once you get going with it, it's much easier once you get started. And once I, you know, the bee came to my mind, I could really build on that and just kind of make sense, although the situation you gave me was quite challenging. But that's just a matter of doing it, so that's kind of how you practice with it. So practice, you know, get us some quotes and some stories you could use. I mean, there's no script. Can you do a million and one things with the topic? I mean, the topic that he had, and so you can kind of take it. Even with politicians, you can ask them a question, and where do they go? Around in circles, up and down, and they really never answer it, but they won't get into that. All right, let's talk about room dynamics and handling the room. As a speaker, like we mentioned before, you are in control, and you have to let the audience what to expect. And what I want to know is, how do you win an audience over? You're coming out, they don't know you from Adam. They don't know who you are or what you represent. And you want to grab their attention the first 30 seconds, obviously, but how do you win them over emotionally? What would you choose to do? Not just one answer. Okay? Greet them at the door and shake their hand, make eye contact. Keep it personal, they can relate, you know, something that the audience can relate with, and, you know, I was there too once. A story, a humor works very, very well. Personal story, being down to earth, that you actually care and that you want to be there, will win your audience over quite a bit. And it's up to the speaker to make the audience choose to pay attention. It's the speaker's responsibility. So you have to know your audience. And we spent some time, we talked about WIFM. And if you were a speaker and they'll ask you, how do you want us to set the room up? How would you want it? How would you like the room set up? How close do you want the seats together? What you're looking for, close together, because the closer together you get the audience, the more they're going to laugh, the more emotions they're going to feel, just because it's contagious. And what most people do is if you're expecting 200 people, you set the room up for 100. And as people start coming in, you start pulling more chairs. And what does that do to the climate of the room? Versus expecting 200 and setting the room for 400 and have everybody spread out. You know the difference? I mean, you're pulling chairs, things are exciting, you have more than you expected, versus there's for everybody, everyone gets 5 seats. You know, temperature we talked about, 68 degrees. You want to make sure that, you know, you probably don't want to have a lectern, you want to have a wireless mic, things to think about. Projector, lighting, all that fun stuff, just take a look at before you get there. But the main thing, you want to set them close together to create that energy and that synergy in the room. What's the location? Is it gymnasium? Probably one of the worst talks. One of the talks that I had a time with was sports camp. I guess it wasn't worse, it was just less than I expected. I had just so many strikes coming against me. Let's see, it was in a gymnasium. Why is that hard? Sound is terrible. The seating's terrible. They just ate dinner. These are all strikes, right? Why is that a problem? Hard to stay awake. Some of them on a sugar high. They're teenagers. That's a strike, right? And then, of course, they give you a topic. So you just have to be careful how things are. Some situations, sometimes you'll be in a church. A lot of, I've spoken in other churches before where a lot of churches rent out their facilities to other groups. And sometimes you'll be speaking in a different group. Sometimes it's a restaurant or their pillars. But again, keep it cold. If it's more than 5 people, have them sit down. You stand up. If it's less than 5 people, it's okay to sit down with the group as far as speaking. So as far as your platform presence, keep the energy of the audience. Keep the audience together. A lot of lights. Can you wear makeup? It's okay for guys to wear makeup. A lot of speakers still wear makeup. You have to be careful where the late cucumbers are going to come and they're not so distractive. And know your topic. But remember that you're in control. What if somebody's having a seizure? Who's in charge? You talk to this. What do you do? What would you do if someone's having a seizure? I mean, I can just go down the list of things that happen as far as, you know, coffee running out, seizures, heart attacks, chokings. Well, you are in charge, and so someone's choking. You say, what do you want to know, first of all? Is there a doctor in the house? You, call 911. Does anybody know Heimlich? And so you just kind of get delegated, even though you don't know what to do. Did I tell you about the time the man his girlfriend went nuts and came in? Did I tell you about that? He's giving a presentation. This man and this woman are sitting together, and I thought she was kind of young for him, but, you know, that's none of my business. Anyway, the back door opens, and this angry woman comes storming in. And I go, oh, man, I can feel this is going to be trouble. That was the man's wife. And he happened to be sitting with some other girl. I don't know what's going on, and she went ballistic. She went nuts. She was yelling, screaming profanity, and of course, that's entertainment for most people. When you're speaking, it's hard to compete with a woman that's riled, yelling profanities at some other man. And the audience is hoping that she might slug him or something like that. So how do you handle that? Well, wait for a little bit, you know. I mean, you tell someone like that to calm down, that doesn't really help the situation. There's only so much you can do, and people were actually enjoying themselves watching it. And I said, you know what, you know, we're in the middle of a meeting here. If you just kind of like take that outside, it would, you know, really help us out. And he walked down. Of course, she followed him, yipping and yapping the whole way. Yeah, I mean, well, there's nothing else you really could do. I mean, you have situations, polka bands next door that are too loud, or weddings going on. I mean, how do you compete with a wedding? Two things happened to me in Florida. One, a wedding was happening. It was a beautiful garden. It was overlooking. Someone was getting married. And that's just one of those moments where people kind of they kind of watch that. And another time in Florida, it was overlooking the ocean. It was a beautiful, but a ship beached itself. It was a huge ship, huge cargo ship. And they had all these tugboats trying to pull it out. And that's, you know, it's kind of interesting. Something like that. Sometimes you want to make sure that the curtains are closed. Depends on the situation. On the wedding, when it got to the point, they were coming, and so I just, we all kind of up and stood and watched them walk down the aisle, and I had someone shut the curtains, and so we kind of acknowledged it and watched it for a little bit, and then we got back to, I mean, it's human nature, it's interesting, it's kind of fun, and so, you know, don't let people watch things like that. Sometimes, you know, they want to watch it more, and their mind gets stuck on that, and you have to just kind of ease that up a little bit. So, just talked about, I just want to hammer that point home, that you are in charge. Sometimes the phone will start to ring. Sometimes someone will fall asleep. How do you handle that? It's not a big deal unless they're snoring. Not to mention what it can do to your self-esteem as a speaker to have someone snoring during your presentation. How do you handle when someone starts snoring? Ask them a question. Yeah, if they'll respond to it, you can ask them a question. You have someone behind them, give them a wet willy. Maybe not. The easiest thing with the snore is hopefully they brought their spouse with them, because if you get a look at the spouse, get the elbow pretty good. So. And if it's bad snoring, you can have someone just touch them and wake them up. Or you have someone like you're speaking and the waiter comes in and starts taking orders in the middle of your speech. Excuse me. You know, if you could do that in here another 10, 15 minutes, we'd really appreciate it. They're usually pretty good about that. Overhead breaks or your projector breaks, you have to be prepared for those. Just a few things. Cell phones, pagers you need to talk about. Someone lights up a cigarette when there's no smoking allowed. How would you handle that? Yeah, politely, see how people it's bothering. This is a huge issue. Someone comes up to you and raises their hand. I have to leave 2 hours early. Am I going to miss anything important? So let's talk about fielding questions. Questions will make or break you as a speaker, the way you handle questions. Now, you need to anticipate the majority of your questions ahead of time as a speaker. A lot of times when you're speaking, you're on a roll and the hands keep going up. Sometimes that's good, but sometimes you want to get through your presentation. If you want to get through your presentation, the easy thing to say is, you know, 99% of your questions are going to be answered throughout my presentation. If you just hold them till the end, I'm confident that I'll answer most of your questions during the presentation. But sometimes you want it interactive and you want people to answer questions. You need to be sincere when you take questions and restate their questions and respect what they're saying. But you have to be prepared for a couple different things. First of all, if you ask for questions and there are no questions, what do? You could keep going. What if it's the very end? I'm opening up. The next 15 minutes is for questions. Okay, that could work. See, this is the question I get most of the time. Or you can plant your mom in the front row with a list of questions to ask. Or usually with questions, you just have to get the ball rolling. I mean, you've been in classes before where it's just the first question's the hardest, and once you get that rolling, it's a lot easier for people to ask questions. This also could mean that you've gone too long, that your audience doesn't speak English, they're ready to leave, but for the most part, you want them to ask questions. But then there are those that are going to ask you tough questions to see what you're made of. You're the expert, you're speaking, and they're going to ask you tough questions to see. Now, as a speaker, as a presenter, do you ever want to say, I don't know?
No.
There are some situations, if it's completely off the wall, it has nothing to do with you and your perceived expertise, you can say, you know, I have no idea, and it's okay to say that. But if the audience perceives you as an expert, and you're an expert in that field, and they expect you to know the answer to that question, and you say, I don't know, guess what's happened to your credibility? It's gone. So, here's the thing. You're up in front, 300 people, and somebody puts you on the spots and asks you a question, and you have no clue what the answer is. How are you going to solve that one? Yeah, you can do the politician and just start talking, and they're like, oh, okay, and they just kind of go around in circles. Okay, that's a good one, and that's a lot of why professors do that. I say, you know, that's a great question, but, you know, that's kind of taking us off on a tangent here. Tell you what, get with me at the break, and I'll get that information to you. Or get with me at the break, and give me your fax number, and I'll fax it to you, or I'll email it to you. Okay, and they do that for a reason. And you can do that in a large situation, too. So get with the break, and when they get with you the break, and they ask you, you say, I have no clue. I have no idea. One person versus 300 people. Right? Or you can research and actually fax it to them. Just watch fax number. What's another option you can do? You have no clue. They expect you to know. Throw it back. Okay? You'll see that happen quite a bit, too. That's a great question. Before I answer, let's go ahead and get the opinion from the audience. What do you guys think? Right? Throw it back. Another tactic you tend to see is have them repeat the question. You see that a lot of this in news conferences. It's not that they didn't understand. It's twofold reasons. A lot of times when they restate the question, it'll be a little more focused. And B, it gives you time to think. So that works very well, too. Or you can restate the question. It also gives you time. I'm just going to throw it back. What do you think? So the way you handle that's very, very important. Now, what about the question hog? How do you deal with the question hog? Okay, I've heard enough of you. Leave? Maybe not. Okay, good. So I love that. Great. Thank you for participating. Really love to hear what you're saying, but I need to get the whole class to participate. Usually it's not you can usually ignore them except for the people that dance in the aisles with their hands up and don't really have a clue. You can talk to them at the break. So, you know, I really appreciate your questions, but I'm trying to get everyone to participate. But then, like I mentioned before, it's better that one person get kicked out than a whole audience dwindle in unbelief, right? Mention that. And that's the truth. If there's one person that's holding your whole audience back, that's causing them to feel tension or not have fun, it's okay to have them removed. What about comments that are venomous, full of venom, ripping on you, your family, your topic, hurtful things? And sarcasm can work. I mean, they're ripping on you. You just have to be careful not to start a war with the type of person that it is. Most of the time you can ignore it, or even simple, some that you learn from your parents. What did you say? You know, most people, didn't say anything. But for the most part, you just kind of ignore it and just not let it get to you. So remember as a speaker that you are the expert, okay? And to visualize your success. And the big part is to realize that the audience wants you to succeed. They want you to be successful. So questions will really help you out on that. So let's talk about the makeup of the audience. Do we know what a demographic is? Everybody understands demographics, right? Age, gender. And so this is something you want to know from your target audience. Know who you're speaking to. Know their occupations. I mean, the way you're going to speak at a religious gathering versus the National Organization for Women versus Boy Scouts of America, all going to be very, very different. And so you ask yourself, male, female, is it mixed, racial, ethnic groups, occupation, will there be teenagers present? So those are some of the things that you look for, that you ask for before you speak so you can customize your message. Age, gender, income, location, race, religion, politics, lifestyle, family status, and education. Obviously the age of the audience is younger. What does that mean to you as a speaker? Relax a little more, speak a little faster, dress a little more casually, have more topics. Gender, that'll definitely affect the way you speak. Income, income's usually in direct correlation to what? Education, a group with high income is going to have higher education. Location, we've talked about. Race will make a big difference. Religion, some religions consider certain things, certain meats or certain foods to be off limits. Politics. Be careful of a lifestyle, the way you're going to talk to young, rich internet people versus older, retired, no money, to be different. Family status, whether married or not, and of course, education. So, just real quick, that's demographic analysis. You know, whether you're at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or American Cancer Society. So, what we usually do when you go to an audience, again, I'm talking long term as far as speaking, is get questionnaires, talk to people about the audience, newspapers, internet, find out about the company, because nothing's worth as a speaker for you to get up there and speak and they know that you really don't know anything about them. And that's what you're trying to get out. And the audience is a mirror of your mood. So you want to become one with them and adapt your speech. Well, let's get into the meat. A lot of stuff to talk about. Excited? So we've been talking about getting to know your audience and analyzing your audience. And there are four factors. This is probably the most important thing that you need to understand is who your audience is, what they like, what they don't like. If somebody asks you to come in to speak, understand exactly what they need. So there's four parts. The first, attitudes and interests. You know, what they have in common. You know, you need to be able to look at any crowd and find something that you have something in common with. If you were to speak at a Star Trek convention and didn't like Star Trek, what would you find in common? Could you find something in common? It could be the creativity. You could use, you know, if I'm speaking on persuasion, Spock is the science of, you know, something about persuasion. But that, I mean, that's part of, if you were talking to morticians or real estate agents, very different crowds. Stock market or stock brokers are very different than weight loss managers, and so you have to look at their attitudes and their interests. And what, of course, is their attitude towards you as a speaker? Do they like you? Do they trust you? Do they know you? Do they not care about you? Do they want to throw things at you? Do they want to leave? That'll help you out quite a bit. You know, finding out what they're interested in. You might think you're a little too young. What is their attitude towards the occasion? Funeral, 4th of July, celebration. Have to be there. And so, spend your time. What's the best way to find out the attitude and interest of the audience? Ask people. Sometimes I'll send out a questionnaire. Go to the internet. Talk to people. The person that pays you or brings you in and wants you to speak, ask them what he's looking for, what they need. Okay, the second one is needs. What do they need? What is their current level of education? What do they want to hear from you? Should you go too fast or too slow? Third one is wants. And fourth one is capabilities. Are they able to understand? Now, I do want to back up to needs real fast, and I'm going to move pretty fast today. And what do you know of mass? Hierarchy of needs. And I'm going to spend a little time on this, but this is important because you need to understand what your audience needs. If you come in to a sixth grade class and try to motivate them to get better paying jobs and to be more motivated and to set their goals, you're missing the mark. Okay? I mean, that's what I mean about needs. If you're coming to a church group, sometimes it's just what they need. And so what Maslow has done is he says there's certain needs that need to be satisfied before you can move on to the next need. So if you were to go to Africa and you were doing a big motivational speech about becoming more successful and achieving more in your life, but they don't even have enough money for food, you've missed the needs. And that's what Maslow's saying here. He says the first need that you have to have satisfied is physiological. I want to live now. Hunger, thirst, sleep, health. So if you're talking to a group of people that have not slept in 24 hours, that's going to affect their needs. Or if they're hungry, if they haven't eaten and they're thirsty. So Maslow's saying, until these needs are satisfied, there's nothing else that you can do. His second is safety. You know, I want to live tomorrow. Protection, comfort, stability, neatness. Meaning, you might be talking about something very, very important, but if the hotel or place is on fire, not going to get very far. Safety is very, very important. And then he says, once those needs are satisfied, they're social. I want to live tomorrow with friends, affiliation, acceptance, participation, and membership. And the fourth, being ego. I want to live tomorrow with friends and be someone special, being in leadership, achievement, recognition. So depending on what you're talking about, what needs you're trying to fulfill into your audience, you won't be able to do that unless these needs are met. And the fifth one, self-actualization. I want to live tomorrow with friends and be someone special and important. Doing things for challenge, stimulation. Most people haven't reached this point, but that's kind of how Maslow's, and I want to show that to you just because you have to understand the needs of your audience and what they need and what they want. So now, capabilities, back to capabilities. Youth, what's the difference between the capability of someone that's 16 and someone that's 35 as far as capabilities? Education, What else is different? Knowledge level, what else is different? Work experience? Attention span, that'll be a big one. How long can they sit there without moving or getting up or doing a group exercise? Definitely. You know, how often do the audience need a break? How long can you sit before you start getting antsy and want to get up? And at least stand up or get a drink or do... What is it about for college? About an hour? 15 minutes or an hour and 50? 15 minutes? Is that true for everybody? Is someone... Half hour? 2 hours? You start getting antsy? Yeah, that's a big part of it, too. It's kind of the Titanic theory. When you're watching... how long was the movie Titanic? 3 hours. The movie that was 3 hours, but you didn't seem that long. And so that's part of it. I mean, there are some classes where 15 minutes, but for some of you, it did seem that long. But for some, it just kind of was interesting. It didn't seem that long. In some classes, when it's interesting and the speaker's keeping your attention, it's much easier than if it is boring. So that is capabilities. Of course, we've probably heard that the mind can absorb only what the seat can endure. And that is a big, big part of it. And that's also, you know, increasing audience participation. Now, how do you increase audience participation? Questions? Jokes? Exercises? Have somebody read? Just keeping people's attention. Big part of the capabilities. But part of that is your supportive material. And that's why we have Tessa. Tessa! We call it the big five that you need to include in pretty much every presentation. Testimony. Example. Statistic, and not necessarily in this order, and I'll move here in a second. Story, and analogy. Test is just an easy way to remember it. So when you're working on your other type of presentations, that's just an easy, it's kind of the big five. You want to make sure there's a testimony from an expert, and we'll spend some time talking about that. An example, a statistic, a story, and analogy. Shall I give you an example? Why do you think we should include all five, first of all? Variety keeps it interesting. There's one more reason. Part of it's that we all have different personalities and we all gravitate to one of them. That's the reason why you do that, because there's different personality types. Let me give you a sample on how to do that. So I want to give you the example of goal setting. Everybody moan for me. Oh, man, you hear that a whole life. You hear it all over the place. You need to set your goals. And so my question to you is, why does goal setting, the word itself, make us cringe? We hear it again and again. Maybe we've tried it and it didn't work. Why else do we cringe when we hear the word goal setting? We hear it all the time. Oh, set your goals. Work, it does require some effort, definitely. And it's amazing, as you look at the research, Yale University did some research with the graduating seniors to see how many of them actually put their goals in writing. We know that if a goal is not in writing, it's just a dream. But when you actually put it down, it becomes reality. But they've noticed that only 3% of the people, and this is true after all the research, 3% of the people actually put their goals in writing. 3%. But the interesting thing, as they follow these people for 20 years, that 3% after 20 years was earning and achieving more than the other 97% combined. It works. We hear about it all the time, but we can't get ourselves to do it. And I think the big reason is we don't know how. For example, if I want to learn how to snowboard, I go up the top of the highest mountain, I say, you know what, I don't need any lessons. How hard can it be? You know, you strap on a board, you go down the hill. So I get up there and I put it on, I go down the hill, and what's going to happen? I'm going to crash, I'm going to hit a tree, I'm going to break my leg, and I'm going to say, you know what, this is a terrible sport, I don't like it, and I'm never going to do it again. And that's what most people have done with goal setting. They don't know the right way to do it. And most people don't, because they don't see the importance, they don't know how. Never been taught how to do it. It's not something that you learn in school. People tell you to do it, but they don't tell you how to do it. There's the fear of rejection, and there's the fear of failure. Okay? And understand that goals need to be realistic and defined. It's just like when you shoot a rocket to a moon. There's mid-course corrections. You can set your goal, but you can change it back and forth a little bit at a time. They need to be realistic and defined. Never should be more than 50% of what you've accomplished in the past. They need to be exciting and meaningful. You shouldn't need an alarm clock to wake yourself up in the morning when you have proper goals that are set, because life is exciting to you. Acted upon and locked upon your mind. Goals triple your commitment level. It works. Again, it's getting ourselves to do that. So I just want to spend a few minutes to show you exactly how they work, because it triples your commitment level. And you can take away the word goal. Maybe you want to use objective. I like to use the word war plan. No, we're at war, but when you think about it, when you have a goal, you should have no other option but to achieve that goal. You want it so bad. It's a war plan, and so you sit down and you take a look at your enemies and your allies and the different things that you need to do. But just for basic goal setting, most people just do the what. What is your goal? Make sure it's specific, measurable, realistic, and exciting to you. The when are you going to accomplish it by? The how? The books, the courses, the family and friends. And the most important, the why. This is the one thing. If you want to learn one thing today, this is it. Because people don't fail because of lack of goals. They fail because of a lack of reasons behind their goals. I don't care you want to be financially independent. I want to know why. We know that goals work, and I guarantee you this work. If you want to try this, I guarantee you it'll triple your commitment level, and you'll see much higher levels of success and accuracy to be able to do the things you want to do. But the why. I've done some work with Dan Jansen. Does anybody know who Dan Jansen is? Olympian, speed skater, gold medalist. Dan Jansen, just to back up, it took him 16 years to get a gold medal. His first Olympics, he was a young kid, but he held the world record. He's one of the best. He was a speed skater. But he got the Olympics, and he was America's boy. He was going to win it all, and he slipped and fell. Both events. Didn't even place. And we all know that Olympics are 4 years apart. So that's devastating. Got back up and trained some more. Went back to the next Olympics. Didn't even place. He held the world record. 4 more years. Went back to the next Olympics. Sister found out his sister had cancer, major problems in the family. Didn't place. Slipped and fell again. 4 more years, 16 years, he stuck on his goal to get that Olympic gold medal. So he got into the race at the Olympics. This was his last Olympics. He was getting old. Didn't place. But then there's that one event, the event that he normally doesn't compete in, that he wanted to compete in just to see if he could do it. He got in. It was one of those incredible moments in Olympic history when he won the gold medal in an event he wasn't even supposed to participate in. He did a victory lap with his chattel. It was, you know, those incredible Olympic moments that gives you the chills, that makes it gets you all excited. We sat down with him. We said, Dan, how did you do it? Most people can't get out of bed in the morning. You persevered for 16 years to get that gold medal. And he says, well, when I was younger, I had a wise coach that sat me down and made me list all the reasons why I wanted that gold medal. For me, for my family, and financially. And I practiced 6 hours a day, 6 days a week to get that gold medal. And half the time, after 4 or 5 hours, I felt like going home and giving up. And when I felt like going home and giving up, I'd pull out that list of reasons for my speed suit, and I'd always find one reason that would inspire me to get me back in the game. And he reiterated that people don't fail because of lack of goals. They fail because of lack of the reasons, the why. And it's critical. You might say, oh, that was nice. But it is a measure. It's no secret that goal setting is a direct indicator of your success, your happiness, and the things you're able to accomplish. And the biggest factor of that is the reasons behind your goal. And so if there's something in your life that you want to accomplish, that you want to do, that you want to improve, you sit down and you list the reasons why. You carry that with you, and I guarantee you, you'll be able to accomplish the things that you really want to accomplish in your life. Thank you. All right. The reason I do that, hey, it's important. It's kind of fun. Let's go over the big five. Make sure I hit them. Testimony. How many? Raise your hands if that's the kind of thing that swayed you a little bit. Example. What was my example? Snowboarding. Snowboarding and the speed skating. Well, I'll leave the story for the speed. So the analogy was a snowboarding. How many kind of hit home with you? The statistics. What were the statistics? 3%, Yale University. The story. Dan Jansen. Well, this is just for an example. The analogy. What was the analogy? I kind of breezed through that one kind of fast. Talked about mid-course corrections. This is about right, actually. Because every one of you gravitated to one thing as far as, and I picked a topic that was a painful topic for most people, right? You're like, oh. It's one of those painful things. I did that just because it's more of a challenge. Testimony, example, and usually these are your bigger ones, your statistic. Why is the statistic so powerful? Kind of makes it real. And always, 99% of the time, the story is the one that hits most people's hearts. Let's spend some time with stories. Probably the best speakers are your best storytellers. What does a story do? You spent a little time with this already. What does the story do?
Captures your mind.
It bypasses every logical thing in your mind, and you just absorb it. You sit there and go. You do. You're just sitting there, and you're sitting in class. You're sitting there, and then all of a sudden, you're not even paying attention. Story. It's amazing. You watch. It's an incredible thing. New Testament, what did Christ teach with? Parables, which are pretty much stories because they just made sense and it's easier for people to comprehend. And we love human interest stories. They command attention and it just keeps us interested. Now, I think you've all tried to retell a story and bombed miserably. And so it is an art form with your pauses, your vocal inflection, your movements. Critical. Critical, critical. Let's back up a second for statistics. The main thing you learn in statistics is that you should never believe statistics, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you can prove anything you want if you question the word right, and so you have to make sure that they're believable. But statistics are powerful, although as a whole as a society, we're believing them more or less than we used to? Less and less and less, because we know. I mean, you can do a lot of different things as far as the way you word it. And so statistics are also very, but make sure they're relevant and reliable.